This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
As a country, Zimbabwe needs its own currency, which can be used to transact locally and internationally. But I think there's been very little in terms of conscientizing the users of the currency in terms of building trust and understanding the need for a local currency.
That's a Harare resident talking about Zimbabwe's efforts to produce a stable national currency. Details coming up. Also, Mauritania's judiciary for the first time ever decides to convict a man for raping a 15-year-old girl. And African immigrants are increasing their presence in the U.S.'s political arena. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, there have been mixed reactions in Cameroon after President Paul Biya said local council and parliamentary elections will finally take place in February, 18 months behind schedule. While the opposition argues that poor security in many areas will make elections impossible, the government says the military has created peace in most of the crisis zones. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé that there was intensive fighting between separatists and the military as the election date was being announced.
Cameroon's military said Monday it was involved in bloody confrontations with separatist fighters in the northwestern towns of Bamenda and Misaje and southwestern towns of Kumba, Mamfe and Muyuka. It gave no casualty figures, but local media reported that at least 9 corpses were discovered by civilians. A day earlier, President Biya set February 9, 2020, as the day for local and parliamentary elections. Senator Emilian Keze of the Opposition Social Democratic Front said Biya's move was expected after the government held a national dialogue last month to discuss the crisis in the English-speaking North, West and South West, which armed groups are fighting to detach from the rest of Cameroon and its French-speaking majority.
The world has heard that we have had a dialogue, and the world is waiting to see the resolution being implemented so that this, our country, whose roots has been shaken, will now find some quietness and some peace.
The SDF and other parties are now holding executive meetings to decide whether they will take part in the polls. The elections were supposed to be held in September 2018, but Biya postponed them, saying it was difficult to organize legislative and municipal polls at the same time as the presidential election held in October last year. Critics said Biya, in truth, was worried by the bad security situation in the separatist regions and in the far north, where troops have been fighting Boko Haram militants since 2014. Political analyst Vitalis Njume of the Cameroon Center for Peace and Development says separatists should drop their guns and allow people in the war zones to vote for their lawmakers.
Those who are fighting and restrict opening up for peace to reign reflect at this moment and open up so that the elite, the politicians, can go back to their various constituencies and see how campaigns and elections can take place peacefully.
Cameroon's Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says the government has asked the military to secure the volatile regions for the elections.
We have security challenges, but everything is put in place. The forces of defense and security, known for their professionalism, will support the administrative authorities in the exercise of their duties. We have security measures that we cannot disclose, but stringent measures have been taken.
The Boko Haram conflict has displaced hundreds of thousands near Cameroon's border with Nigeria, while the separatist crisis has killed an estimated 3,000 and displaced about 500,000 more. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
In Mozambique, five soldiers employed by the Wagner Group, a private military firm with connections to the Kremlin, and 20 soldiers in Fadum, the Mozambique Defense Armed Forces, were killed in an ambush on October 27th. Insurgents were said to have burned two vehicles in the ambush in the Cabo Delgado province of Mudemba district, according to Carte de Mocambique, a local publication. Salem Salomon reports.
The possible deaths in northern Mozambique of military contractors employed by a Russian firm are raising new questions about Russia's security presence in Africa. Jasmine Oberman is a researcher and terrorism expert in South Africa.
Clearly, they walked into an ambush. Consequently, there was a skirmish taking place that resulted in 20 FADM soldiers being killed. That's the Mozambican security forces, and five Russians. Two military vehicles destroyed, and then there's also unverified information that some of the soldiers fled the scene. Clearly caught by surprise, not being prepared for this.
VOA reached out to the Mozambique government for comment, but did not receive a response. Russia denies its soldiers are in Mozambique, and Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said earlier in October, as far as Mozambique is concerned, there are no Russian soldiers there, according to Russian state-owned media. Peskov added that his country is more focused on forging economic and security ties with African nations. But the killing last week, counterterrorism experts warn, show the growing sophistication of insurgent groups operating in the region and bring into question the effectiveness of Russian private military contractors assisting African governments. For more than 2 years, several Islamic militant groups have carried out attacks in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado region. The government has relied on Russian mercenaries to help contain the violence and protect vast reserves of natural gas.
We are seeing them now more in a guerrilla type of war. Retreat, attack, creating the surprise element. And the Russians, I think at this point in time, have been caught unaware of this level of sophistication and weapons available to the insurgents.
DefenseWeb, a South African security publication, reported that four of the Russian soldiers shot during the ambush were later decapitated. The fifth soldier died of wounds in a hospital, according to the site. But experts on the region are urging skepticism of information circulating online and via social media, including photos of dismembered bodies. Yusuf Adam is an associate professor of contemporary history at the University of Eduardo Mondale in Maputo.
They've been decapitated or no? I think there is too much invention around. If you go into WhatsApp, there is a lot of photos going around about attacks in Mianguleve, and when you look at the photograph, they are all fake, because most of the insurgents, when they do attacks, they are dressed with Mozambique army or police special forces equipment.
Adam added that the weaponry in some of the pictures shared was questionable. Those photographed are holding 12-gauge shotguns, but insurgents in the region more commonly carry AK-47s. According to local media reports, the Russian soldiers killed in later October were employed by the Wagner Group, a private military company owned by Yevgeny Prigozhin, a Russian oligarch with close ties to President Vladimir Putin. Michael Carpenter is a senior director of the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement.
Prigozhin's Wagner Group is acting as an official, almost like an official arm of state policy in Russia. I mean, obviously it's not officially recognized, and yet it serves as a convenient proxy for the Kremlin.
Carpenter said the arrangement is similar to privateers. Operating hundreds of years ago, state-sanctioned mercenaries or pirates will help carry out the foreign policies of countries like England, Spain, and Portugal.
When Prigozhin goes in and provides consulting services, either personal protection services to a dictator or election support services or mercenaries who can be helpful in guarding certain strategic assets in a given country, he paves the way for other Russian corporations to do business in those countries.
Salim Salomon, VOA News, Washington.
Zimbabwe's central bank says It has begun circulating lower denomination banknotes and coins in an effort to help end severe shortages of cash and boost the new Zimbabwean currency. But as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, many have doubts the new money by itself will improve the country's struggling economy.
By close of business Monday, most banks in Harare did not have the allocations of the new money. The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe said it would comment once it has ensured that deliveries have been made to all banks. Harare resident Kudakwache Muchena is one of those tired of the cash shortages that have made life difficult for Zimbabweans over the past 2 years. He thinks the government needs to do more to boost confidence in the domestic currency, known as the bond note, after a decade of using US dollars and South African rand.
As a country, Zimbabwe needs its own currency, which can be used to transact locally and internationally. But I think there's been very little in terms of conscientizing the users of the currency in terms of building trust and understanding the need for a local currency.
Zimbabwe abandoned its own currency in 2008 due to extreme hyperinflation. The new currency faces an uphill climb as it does not trade beyond the country's borders and has lost value since being introduced in June. Nonetheless, Harare resident Larry Quirirai hopes the new currency succeeds.
In principle, of course, it's a good idea to have our own currency, but as always with many things in Zimbabwe, it will come down to policy, consistency and that sort of thing, especially around the monetary and fiscal policy. And also coming up with a budget, what's the budget going to say? There are many questions around it because the currency will have to be supported by production. And that's where the big thing is. And the success or lack of success of it is underpinned by the success outside the currency itself.
Zimbabwe's economy has struggled for 2 decades amid political turmoil and government policies widely seen as unfriendly to farm production and foreign investment. Clinton Musonza, an economist at the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe, says the country's cash shortages are far from being over.
The coming in of new notes is not going to end all the cash problems in Zimbabwe per se, because you have to understand that the challenges that Zimbabwe is facing are emanating from the production side. So if, as long as we are not producing enough, we are going to be in this kind of situation for long.
Musonza says lower denomination bond notes will improve the availability of cash, but notes that the government would prefer to see Zimbabwe become what it calls cash light. Since the cash shortage started, the central government has encouraged Zimbabweans to conduct transactions electronically. But many businesses still insist on hard money in exchange for goods and services. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
In Zimbabwe, experts say the deteriorating economic crisis is fueling gender-based violence. Rutendo Mawera reports from Harare.
The Zimbabwe Gender Commission says gender-based violence is on the rise in the country and blames it on the economy. Speaking Thursday at a church campaign launch called Speak Out, where the churches are fighting the scourge and encouraging survivors to talk, Gender Commissioner Sibongile Mawuye said,
"What is fueling gender-based violence in Zimbabwe is mostly economic pressure, economic challenges, which is causing a lot of tension within families."
Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Council of Churches, Reverend Kenneth Mtata, agrees and says the economy has put especially men under a lot of pressure.
"The weakening of the economic strength of families, and this has a huge bearing on the men who tend to be the breadwinners. And if they are no longer able to take care of families, sometimes they feel under so much pressure to say, how do I still exercise my image as the head of the family? And as a way to try and demonstrate that they are still in charge of family, sometimes they match violence against their wife and children."
Motata adds that poverty in the country has also driven individuals to be easily abused.
And I think also we have seen that due to limited resources and opportunities, many people are vulnerable to abuse in exchange for possibilities in life.
The church say it is campaigning against gender-based violence after the realization that society was almost normalizing abuse. Sostina Takure, coordinator for the Action by Churches Together Alliance, says the church can no longer be silent as gender-based violence is rising at alarming levels.
So we are a faith network and we realize that we have to come together and stand up and speak out against gender-based violence, because it is happening in our churches, it is happening in our communities, and the women in the church, the girls in the church are the ones who are being affected.
Minister of Women Affairs, Community, Small and Medium Enterprises Development agrees that gender-based violence has become a cause for concern. An officer in the ministry, Ernest Chimboza, said abuse is rampant even in churches, which are expected to be places of safety. Chimboza said government is aware of the problem and is creating one-stop centers for survivors of gender-based violence.
A survivor needs medication, needs counseling, needs the legal assistance. So it will be found per one place. There is no need for the survivor to move from place to place. So we are advocating as a ministry to come up with what we call one-stop centers.
The UN Population Fund says in Zimbabwe, one in every three women between the ages of 15 to 49 has experienced physical violence, and one in four have suffered sexual violence since the age of 15. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
You are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights welcomes the conviction and sentencing of a man for rape by a court in Mauritania. Lisa Schlein reports from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
Mauritania does not have a law to prevent gender-based violence and rape. In the past, almost all cases of sexual violence have gone unpunished. In a surprising turnabout, a court has sentenced a 30-year-old man to a 5-year prison term for having raped a 15-year-old girl in Kayedi, a city in southern Mauritania. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville tells VOA this is an encouraging first step.
If that can be followed up with proper legislation, and that legislation then starts to be properly enforced, then perhaps women will be encouraged to come forward more often, because there is a foreseeable result to coming forward. But clearly that's always a hugely personal and painful decision to make for any individual woman or girl, how to react to being raped.
Mauritania has a law that criminalizes consensual sex outside marriage. Human rights observers say this law deters women who have been raped from reporting the crime for fear of themselves being charged and imprisoned for adultery. Female victims of sexual violence who become pregnant are stigmatized and often sent to prison for breaking the country's law banning sex outside of marriage. Colville says the 15-year-old rape victim was impregnated by her assailant, compounding her difficulties.
She has been, and we've played a part in this, providing her with shelter and some kind of socioeconomic support to help her initially, but we definitely call on the authorities to really formally compensate her and ensure she's properly cared for.
On two occasions, a draft law making gender-based violence a crime has been presented to the Majlis, the country's parliament, and rejected. The UN Human Rights Office is urging the parliament to relaunch the discussion on the draft bill and to adopt it as soon as possible. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Environmental Investigation Agency, EIA, based in Washington, D.C., has released a new web-based tool that allows Ghanaian citizens to know the quantity and value of illegal rosewood imported into China from Ghana every month. Mavis Ocheri. in Washington has more.
Ghana's government has been cutting down rosewood trees and selling the wood. But September data from the EIA shows that Ghana is still one of the largest exporters of rosewood in West Africa. Rosewood is in very high demand in China, where it is often used to make imperial-styled furniture. The EIA's web says more than 9,330 tons of rosewood worth $5.4 million was imported into China from Ghana in September despite the ban. In addition to violating national laws, this export raised serious questions about Ghana's implementation of the Convention on International Trade in Wild Species of Fauna and Flora. The West African rosewood species has been protected by the International Convention since 2017. EIA estimates that since 2012, more than 540,000 tons of rosewood, the equivalent to 23,478 20-foot containers, or approximately 6 million trees, were illegally harvested in Ghana and shipped to China while the ban has been in place. Kidan Araya, EIA's African program campaigner, says the web-based tool was designed to complement Ghanaian government, civil society, and media efforts to crack down on illegal rosewood trade.
Ghanaian citizens were really the first ones to ring the alarm on the rosewood crisis in their country. Over the years, several civil society groups and media outlets have reported on the rosewood crisis extensively with help from communities that are most impacted by the rosewood crisis. And the Ghanaian public appear to be very concerned about what's happening with rosewood in their country. We think making the data public allows for Ghanaians to also aid in these recent efforts by the government to investigate the rosewood issues through making them accountable.
She says the organization's investigation documents a massive institutionalized timber trafficking scheme enabled by high-level corruption and collusion.
Our investigation earlier this year revealed that some of the CITES permits were being signed under the influence of corruption and collusion. EIA even obtained a CITES permit that was signed months after the rosewood had already been shipped out of Ghana and reached China. So the illegalities of the system are there, and they must be addressed in order for CITES to be effectively implemented.
She says in September, 2,334,497 kilograms of rosewood valued at 5,462,471 US dollars has been exported illegally to China. Araya called for trade in rosewood to be suspended across West Africa for China to comply with international agreements on endangered species.
This is not just a Ghana problem, it's a China problem. And we think that this crisis will also be solved more if Ghanaian and Chinese authorities work together.
Araya says massive institutionalized timber trafficking enabled by high-level corruption and collusion needs to be addressed urgently, and transparency in the timber sector in Ghana needs to be improved. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.